Welcome, friends, to Tanked Up, the podcast all about video games and beer. I'm one of your hosts, Ben, here with Adil.
Hey!
Hey! It's episode 451. And we're going to drink some beers, talk about some games. Adil, what have you got to drink this evening?
You're familiar with the Weekend Project?
Yes.
It turns out, it's their Elephant Rock in quotes. Oh, it says drink from the can! Exclamation point. Interesting. So it's a double IPA, 8%. Gorgeous. They usually have these white cans, and this is like and apparently what they've started doing is aping really popular beers in the States.
Okay.
Is what Ben over at the Hop Knocker was telling me. And I can't remember what this one was supposed to be. So I'm going to do a quick search, but it says, drink from the can, exclamation point. No explanation needed. A celebration of our many trips to Vermont, a hazy double featuring the classics, Cascade, Simcoe, Centennial, Citra, and Chinook.
Nice.
So like very, very hop loaded.
Mm.
I'm assuming it's some sort of Vermont, popular Vermont beer, but I don't know what it's supposed to be. Obviously they can't say that on their buzz. I've not really ever been disappointed by Weekend Project, so I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, they do some good beers. Absolutely. I'm going the other end of the spectrum and drinking a lower percentage beer. It's only 5.2, but this is Arbor's Panettone. It's a festive pale ale. You can see in a lovely green and red can. So, obviously, lots of more wintry beers starting to appear. I've started stocking up on a few stouts and things. So, I thought, yeah, why not? We'll give this one a go as a festive pale ale. There is a little bit of flavor text.
Mm-hmm.
Our take on a festive ale. Brewed with raisins, lemon, and clementine zest. And finished with a little vanilla, so it's aping a fruitcake, a panettone, that kind of very potentially spiced. We'll see if anything like that comes through in the beer. Are you drinking it from the can? Are you going to drink it from a glass? What are you doing?
I mean, I feel like if the only flavor text is drink from the can. Feel like I should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you probably can.
It says it. So just to be clear, right? For you audio only listeners, sorry. But if you look at the glare. It says drink from the can, all the way on the top rim of the label. Like all the way around. So I will not tell you about its...
Wait, you just pour coloring. A tiny bit into a glass just to see what it...
Yeah, okay. That's actually... Yeah, so I poured 15 mils, something like that.
Yeah.
It's hazy. You can actually see how effervescent it is. There's so many bubbles. Mm. Almost no head in that quick splash. Who knows the fuck that means? but it is reasonably clear. Oh, you can't quite tell how clear
you,
it is.
You can. Like, you can. You get a little bit of that. Yeah.
So it's hazy, but not opaque. The lights in the room are reflecting really nicely through it from my perspective, which will be the opposite from the camera. Nosing it in this very empty glass, maybe not a good idea. I'll just that's so different. So you're getting like melon, pineapple, a little bit of sweet citrus. It's a really soft nose, actually.
Hmm.
But all dem hops are not fighting. It's a really smooth nose. Like I said, kind of like a touch tropical, a touch sweet citrus, and then a little bit of, like, I think melon rounding it out. Yeah, smells gorgeous. As an 8%, definitely by the nose you couldn't tell. Like it's just because it's really like low key on the nose front. Mm-hmm. Low key on the nose front is... the post-noise album that my college roommate tried to release. Ooh. That's really good. It's smooth. It's again, exact. It enters immediately into these 2025 high ABV doesn't taste like it
right
lists that we could easily have. If only in the past like four episodes, we probably have five entries on it.
Yep.
Right away, you're getting that backbone of bitterness from the hops. Like, you just have this, oh yeah, this is a beer. This is an IPA. But it's not, like, it's not smack you in the face. It's just, like, there's the main sort of backbone of the taste is sort of that classic bitter IPA. But it's melded very well with this. Like I said, not quite as sweet as tangerine, but the sweet citrus. As the taste moves on, you're getting a... you're getting a bit of malts and sort of after this hit of, yes, this like good, solid, hoppy mouthfeel and taste. So you're like, as the main taste fades, you're immediately like, ah, yes, that hoppy backbone's there. A little bit of malts show up. Right now it's a bit sweet, which I suspect once my palate acclimatizes, that'll go away. I really skipped the main taste. Oh, yeah. So it's all those elements of the nose. You're getting a bit more of that tropical. That, like, sweet citrus is mostly is being a bit overwhelmed by the other stuffs. But that's great because it has the longer finish. So you move into it. If I really focus on that, like, in the initial swish, I can taste it. But, like,
nice.
It's not a main taste.
Hmm.
And again, that like that. I'm trying to think. I was getting honeydew and cantaloupe mixed up. I think it's a bit cantaloupey melon, and just like that extra bit of a quirk. That's why I'm like, oh, melon, not just generic sort of sweet watery fruit. which was the aforementioned college roommate's stage name. Yeah. It's incredibly drinkable. I feel like my description of the main taste isn't doing justice. It's just, it's so solid. Mm. And what's really interesting is if I'm focusing, I can pick out these other flavors, but it's actually just has this really strong core flavor. Like all of the different hops are really well balanced. So instead of like having this, like, except for that, like slightly more sweet citrus, which again, I think needs the other stuff to pull away before it comes in the fore. The rest is like there, and I could dissect it, but it wouldn't be describing the taste, accurately, because it's just like really good melded taste. It's not like one of those beers where you sort of have the taste sort of ebbing and flowing. So you're like, oh yeah. So like right at the forefront, it's this. And then that fades a bit enough for this part to come in. No, it's just nice. Really well melded. And I feel like if I describe it just like that, you people might think, oh, so it's like, not nuanced, but I think it's actually just the nuances are stitched together. Again, please remind me this is 8%. I already had a beer at the bottle shop earlier while I was picking this up. Yeah, it's an excellent beer. So even a few sips in, talking for too many minutes, it is interesting because I think the biggest, like, betrayal of the ABV is the fact that sweetness lingers a lot longer on the finish. So if you actually take the time to go 30, 45 seconds into the finish before another quaff, you're like, oh, it's a bit sweet.
Mm.
And I'm noticing now that sweetness is there, but that the citrus has already faded. Uh-huh. So it's just like a little hoppy bitterness. The maltiness is just there for a little bit. And it's just like, oh yeah, I've had a beer. But I have this lingering sweetness. Oh, right, it's 8%. That's probably where that's coming from because the other stuff has faded away.
Yeah, yeah, okay, nice.
Yeah.
Good, sounds lovely.
It's fucking great, man.
I haven't had anything from the Weekend Project for ages.
Ben, other Ben, brings the Weekend Project really regularly, and they've become like my almost like, oh, there's a new weekend project. If it's in 10, I'll probably grab it for later.
Nice.
If it's on tap, I almost always, because also this is like an outlier. Apparently last week where I didn't go to the Hop Knocker. That's right. There are weeks where I don't go to the pub. That pub, let's be honest. Apparently it was really great on tap, but nice. Dangerous because it's an 8%.
Absolutely.
But there's a regular rotation, and I couldn't be happier about it because they put more. So the pub goes in like waves where you can tell there's nothing super. Basically, I have a suspicion, though I haven't confirmed this, where if there isn't a super exciting like above 7 session straight like ale, especially an IPA or something. That's when we get like a keg of Steady Rolling Man in, because it's always like reliable, etc. But it's not new, and mm-hmm. sometimes it's like a few of those. It's clearly like a few kegs of those in a row. But like there are weeks like this where there was a couple collaborations, a couple weekend projects, and then on to the harder, like the stronger stuff.
Sure.
Like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But this is because the Steady Rolling Man is like not. Mainstay, but weekend project beers, even though they rotate because they're much more craft in that sense. I don't think they have moved to that stage of sort of brewer who has enough feedback that they know, like this one, if we make it all the time, we have a regular.
Yeah, they don't have a core range.
Yeah,
to them.
Core. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah. So because of that, it's like whatever their like 4 or 5% one is, and it's like great. I'll probably always start with that unless the thing on cask, because they've this year actually, or way earlier in the year, Ben brought in a cask pump. So it's like, oh, well, if the cask doesn't have lactose and seems interesting, I might start with that. But like most nights I go there for more than a beer, I'm probably going to have something weekend project just because it's in that like great mid zone. So I've had a lot of them and I've not been disappointed. So seeing a higher ABV offering of them and it being this like just from the immediate sip, I was like, oh, I will enjoy this. And it's only nice. Growing on me. Although now I'll have it from a cup and maybe I'll hate it.
It's completely different. Couldn't be any more different. Good. I will kick into this. This had a lovely big nose. When I cracked it.
It's also still as shit.
I mean, it is. It had a little bit of head when it poured. I just tapped the top of the glass, see if any of that kind of comes back. No. Maybe the can is not quite hard enough to do it. But super clear. Little sort of brownie. Almost sort of a burnt amber kind of colour, really. But very, very clear. Big nose. Lovely big nose. A lot of sweetness. That vanilla's coming through on the nose as well, which is nice. Because very rarely does it sort of punch through that much. You kind of get it as a more of a follow-up kind of flavor that's enhancing sort of other stuff. So definitely that vanilla. A little bit of malt. It does sort of smell cakey. You know, it has that nose to it, like a baked goodie. Maybe not panettone, but, you know. It's actually quite carbonated when I sip it, you know.
You're feeling those bubbles?
Feeling those bubbles, absolutely. And there's a tiny bit on there. You can kind of see the carbonation if you're looking kind of closely enough, still bubbling away. It's interesting because it's a very light, as maybe the body and the colour and the opacity would suggest. It's a very light beer. It's very wet. And it is full of flavour.
What was the ABV again?
5 point something. It's lighter. 5.2. It has. I mean, it's as they sort of say. It's got that little bit of citrus and that zing that the clementine zest is giving you. You're getting that vanilla in there, absolutely. You're getting a little bit, and I think I sort of said maybe it's got a bit of a spice to it. And it does have a slight, or it feels. A little bit spicy, but I think that's maybe more the raisin kind of coming in and being quite different to the other flavours. But it almost tastes like a bit of a golden rum. you know.
Oh, interesting.
Not quite Mount Gay, something maybe a little bit more spiced, but sort of a spiced golden rum. It's got that feel to it. It's a little bit, you know, colder, but with that little bit of zest, that little bit of lemon in there, it's like a golden rum with a little shot of lemonade. You know, you've almost sort of, you've put in a shot of rum and you've put in a shot of lemonade with it. 50-50 kind of mix rather than a, you know, rum and lemonade. So it's lovely. It's a very, very nice flavor, but there's not, it doesn't feel big, you know. It feels like I could just drink and drink and drink and not really kind of feel anything from it. Which I think is absolutely fine. And as a festive pale, actually your first beer on a, you know, a festive holiday day, a day off, around lunchtime, just as you're starting to wither from, you know, presents and cooking and all those kinds of things, this would be a very nice opener on a nice cold day when you're sort of, you know, drinking from the early afternoon, let's say. Definitely getting more of that raisin as I'm drinking more of it as well. That is the element that's giving that kind of like that illusion of spice, I think.
That's really good, yeah. Raisins, yeah. Underexplored, I want to say, in beer.
Mm.
Or at least in non, like, dark beer fruited.
Yeah. I feel like we get a few beers with raisin or something like, maybe not like prunes, but it's edging towards that kind of,
right, okay.
That,
so that like
slightly
rich spice,
slightly rich. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And this works very well. This combination of sort of flavors works very well with that maltier kind of base, that kind of slightly cakey feeling that I'm getting from the flavor as well, which is giving me that little bit of sweetness kind of running through. So this is a lovely combination of flavors. Very light beer, very easy to drink, will disappear very, very quickly, even though it's Arbor and it's a pint. But like all the beers we drink, I think pretty much most of them go back fairly easily. So let's launch into games, because we've only got about half an hour until these beers are gone, probably. Yeah. What should we start with? Should we start with a little bit of news? Maybe start with just a few thoughts on the Steam hardware release from the week?
Yeah. This might segue into the thing that I cut us off from talking about before we started streaming. But for those of you who don't know, Steam announced three pieces of kit. The first being the Steam Controller 2.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially so it's a controller. They've done the smart thing, which is two joysticks, but it's essentially giving you the exact same input schema as what's on the Steam Deck. So you have the two triggers on the top, but the bottom triggers are I can't remember the term. They're not like digital, right? So how much you press it will change. So they're really good for throttles.
Yeah.
They also have the like back buttons that you can. So if you're holding a Steam Deck or the OG Steam Controller 2, right? You would as well. Just said OG Steam Controller 2. You've got these extra buttons you can push with your bottom fingers. That's there. You've got the two trackpads, but in the OG Steam Controller, which I still have one of. And it's my living room controller until I found the 8-bit Duo in purple. And the 8-bit Duo is probably my favorite PC controller. It like feels, it's everything the game, the Switch Pro controller is, and without the trade-offs against like an Xbox controller. That's how I would put it, right? And it just works. It's got a dongle, but it also has a Bluetooth. So Ooh. It's got those. So the trackpads are just like on the Steam Deck, sort of
adaptive
below. So you
triggers.
Reach down with your thumbs so that the main position you are on is on the joysticks, which was the biggest problem with the Steam controller. That, and it only had one joystick and it had this weird D-pad / touchpad thing, which it didn't work reliably enough to be that, but also that it just was trying to do too many things, which is one of the things I love about Steam is they tried that thing, right?
Like, absolutely.
And I think a lot of what it was doing was before its time, and unfortunately because games aren't coded for those unique inputs, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's kind of one just on that, the older hardware.
Yeah.
And this kind of refresh and this new sort of step forward is really good, I think. Obviously, what Valve have been sort of working on for the last few years. But a lot of this sort of stuff is iterations of things, right? So the Steam controller is you know, the second kind of version of it. The Steam Machine, which is a mini PC, they've been trying to get kind of put together for years. I remember a time several years ago where they were, Steam Machines were going to come out in a variety of different sort of specifications made by different manufacturers. And they've kind of gone, well, that didn't really work out. Let's just make one ourselves.
Perhaps. Yeah. So before we move on from that, I'm just going to say, like, from what I'm looking at, I have a home theater / mini PC with like 16 gigs of RAM and a mini PC AMD chip and a video card. But like, one of the things I've realized that I was not doing, even as a big nerd, was because it's in the same house as my PC with its decent graphics card and like Moonlight exists, streaming, like Wi-Fi, home Wi-Fi, and when I moved to my new house, hopefully in 2025, it'll be wired. There's enough bandwidth where the latency is not bad that I can play most games to the ability that I play them in my living room from streaming with like Moonlight. And so it was like, oh, because I was kind of like, do I need this home theater PC? Because I could just use the Steam Deck, but I care enough about graphical fidelity that like I can tell the difference between a docked Steam Deck and streaming from Moonlight. Oh, over Wi-Fi,
sure.
With, and it's like, oh, but also I kind of like the fact that if I'm holding the Steam Deck and learning certain games with that pattern, I can just put my hands closer together and have a controller. So I'm kind of pumped about that in a way that I've not really been for a controller, just because now that the Steam Deck has brought me back to certain types of games that aren't controller based, but it works so well in them that it was like, oh, I could play this in my living room. And I'd probably play it more often now that I'm used to this type of navigation. I don't want this 8-bit duo only, right? Like, but if I'm playing a regular controller-based game, I'd probably pick up the purple controller because it just feels natural. But I think if I got the Steam controller too, at some point I'll just grab it by accident and realize I can do the other thing because it's just as good. So just if you haven't read all the articles, the last thing I'll say about the Steam controller is it's a new magnetic mechanism to have smaller dead zones, less likelihood of breakdown, etc. Like they've iterated the joystick in an actual, like, one of the fundamental like improvements in this sphere. And from what I understand, that should be modular replaceable as well. Don't quote me on that because there's not enough information, but just the way they put out the schematics and the way they've done things in the past. So the Steam Deck, Steam Machine is, it's essentially, again, hilariously, it's just a PC running Linux, and hardware that is slightly less good than a PS4 and on par with the Xboxes. But it's running Linux with Proton GE, and that we know from the Steam Deck, it can do almost anything. And it's better than the Steam Deck. And because you're not running all the Windows bloat, those trade-offs are probably in their favor. And again, most people don't have 4K TVs.
Yeah.
Let alone 4K 120 hertz. And so I think a lot of people were like, these specs seem crappy. I'm like, yeah, but you're probably going for 1080. Like, it's a living, I think it was designed as a living room PC.
Absolutely. Right? Yep.
It's supposed to be a console, which means most people don't have, like, you can push as many frames as you want. Your TV's only 60 hertz. for the more hardcore, that hardware can easily push 1080p to your 120 hertz fancy TV and 1440 as well, because it's just, I think it's part of the thing we've been like talking about on and off, which is like the graphics card arms race of resolution and TVs and stuff. Just like, people got to 1080p, a lot of people stopped. Some people got to 4K. I have a 4K TV in my living room because I bought it refurbished off of eBay, I think. Cheaper than I could get a, like, as good as, like, a, like a, it was just a cheap TV. Sure. And I almost never fed it 4K. I've noticed since I've plugged in this mini PC, it's a Minis Forum, for those of you who care. DM me on Service of Choice if you want to know more about that. And at 4K with something that serves at that, I can, if I'm streaming something or playing something at 1080p, I'm annoyed because I can tell, like, I have too many pixels on my screen, and I don't, for most sources are not 4K still, so it's like, oh, if I had a 1080p screen, I don't see pixels from my couch, so my pixel density is fine. But with a 4K or a 1080p image stretched to 4K, I can tell that it's being stretched. And if I just had a 1080p screen, it would look better. That sucks, right? But there's also, I've seen a couple people on YouTube also being like, saying the similar thing, but also as videographers being like, wouldn't it be great if we just had all of this investment in tech on really portable, really high dynamic range 1080p? If we had done that instead of racing to 6K, because what's really funny now is all these fancy cameras out there that can record 4K 120 or 6K or maybe 8K, their quality of 1080p, because of the trade-offs involved in doing that, is worse than cameras, you like 2 megapixel cameras that were reasonably good high-end 10 years ago. And you're like, oh, but no one would complain with, like, if you had the fidelity, you wouldn't care about the lack of pixel density, but actually you're just making the 1080p worse. Anyway, so the Steam Machine, I was supposed to be talking about its stats, and now I have to find them because I've been rambling.
Well, that's I mean, we can go into those kinds of things. No, I don't. I didn't look at the Steam Machine. I'm currently on the, actually, the one that interests me the most is actually the Steam Frame.
Okay, so I wanted to just, like, say a bit about the specs, but essentially, it's a cool black box, like literally a cube. It's got good inputs. It also has a programmable RGB strip.
Yes.
Above the
IO. Different faceplates and stuff, isn't it? Like,
yeah, and swappable faceplates at some point, but they don't know what that is. But I think the programmable strip, like giving you the ability to be like, you got an email, it looks like this. You got a, you know, a game inviting request. Suddenly your bar goes red in the middle of a game. That's neat, right?
It is. I think the Steam Machine, though, it's sort of a thing that isn't maybe aimed at, like, you or I.
No, because we have the gear for the
Because we have the gear. This is like an entry-level PC that, as you say, is probably more competing with home consoles. It's for the living room. It's for people who play, you know, maybe they've got a Steam Deck and they want to do something else and they have a slightly different experience and connect it to the telly rather than, you know, they've got a bigger PC or they want that ability to have that. They haven't got a home console, they've got a PC, but they want to have some kind of experience in the living room. Because I think a lot of these have the ability to stream as well, don't they? So you're not necessarily installing all of your games on, say, the Steam Machine. Although I think they have this Steam Machine has got a micro SD card, so you can
So same thing with the Steam Deck. You can always put a micro SD card, which currently you can not unaffordably get a 1 terabyte micro. In the grand scheme of hard drives and PCs, right? Like, get a micro SD card that could put a terabyte back on, which is why I've bought 2 Steam Decks, and they've always been 512. Because and the thing is, the other part is I researched how to swap the drives anyway, which I could send you tutorials for that, the model that you have currently. If you yes. thought the 512 was not big enough and you got a good deal on a
so NVMe it's interesting because I've been actually a game that I won't talk about this week, but I have been playing. So I'm only like 40 minutes into it, but actually I've just been streaming it from the PC. Well, so on this the is Steam Deck, and it works absolutely brilliantly.
Yeah.
Like, I got no issue with it at all. No latency, no kind of slowdown, nothing.
So this is the thing why I mentioned Moonlight is because if Steam streaming is pretty good for a lot of games. If you have like games that you need to have lower latency, but installing Moonlight on your PC, mm-hmm. And then installing Sunlight on your PC, Moonlight on your streaming machine, I tried because I have the Minusform home theater PC with Windows 11 in the living room, and I tried Steam the game I still haven't talked about on but I haven't touched it in weeks, so it's not worth me bringing up now, but Baldur's Gate 3 I played on this machine.
Yep.
Looks great. I've got a 4K screen in front of me. I've got a few years old graphics card. It still works great. Streamed it with Steam Remote Play, and it was a bit choppy. Installed Sunlight Moonlight, world of difference. Mm. And there's Linux clients for Sunlight for Moonlight, so you could do that on your Steam machine as well to get better remote play. And of course, they're not locking it down. It's just Linux.
Mm.
That's great.
Yeah,
but yeah, for a lot of games, you don't even need that. You can just click the button on Steam because Steam's automatically on both of them, and you want it on both of them because you want to play games on both of them.
Exactly.
I think that's why it's a really cool thing, because it could just be your entry level to... Yeah, exactly. What you were saying. If it's your first PC, you'll be happy with it because you'll get console-like performance for most games for a couple years. In the same way that in a couple years it might get outclassed. But again, at 1080p, that outclassing is sometimes a lot on paper. If you're a more hardcore gamer and you haven't done what I've done, which is essentially made my own version of this thing, that then it's like, oh, what if you wanted to stream these games? Because that thing's way beefier than my tiny... Like, I bought a small form factor PC to like hide it, so it wasn't a big... eyesore, and also had very low power draw when right, and that's why streaming from my main PC to it is great. It's mostly just my like YouTube, Netflix, you know, Spotify if I'm reading in the living room machine, right?
Mm.
And it's like, oh, but the Steam machine, if you haven't already done that type of thing, the Steam machine will be more expensive than one of these things, which is like $100. But it can do more because there's a lot of games it would play natively. So, like, if I had something like that, in fact, what I'm thinking about doing is installing a Linux distro on that machine because the Windows is so shitty. And Proton GE works great. Right? It's like, put all my party games, put all my couch co-op games, right, on that machine and stream the rest from the main PC, and then I don't even have to worry about power draw or streaming because it's like, oh yeah, I turn this machine off. People come over, we play Jackbox or, you know, Duck Game. Because Duck Game's great.
Yes, yeah.
And any machine you buy now can play Duck Game, right?
Absolutely, like, yeah.
Right, couch co-op games tend not to have that high... I guess there's this new phenomenon of the two-player couch co-op, like that divorce game. I can't remember what it was called. I just called it the divorce game. But anyway, so that's the Steam machine. I think you're right. It fits exactly in it fits like the two niches, right? The new to PC gaming, want to try it out. And then the, like, I'm a hardcore PC gamer, but I don't have a living room solution.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think they've tried this before, right? So they had, which is now just what they call their just the service, which is Steam Link. They had a Steam Link box.
Oh yeah, this is clearly an iteration, and what they realized was the Steam Link by itself didn't do fuck all.
Well, I mean, the Steam Link, I liked my Steam Link. I've still got it in a box somewhere. I haven't hooked it up since I've got it.
I don't mean it wasn't useful, but it was a remote-only kind of deal.
Yes, it was, absolutely.
By itself, it didn't do anything. And so they've basically said, here's an affordable, well-specced machine that we can guarantee works and can play a shit ton of games at console level in your living room and still can be a Steam Link for the heavier stuff.
Yeah, very much, very much.
And so I think,
come on. I was going to say, it's a clever, clever move to sort of all of these things that they've been building on for the last sort of 15 years or so. I don't know when Steam Link kind of first came out, but it probably hasn't been produced for about 5-6 years, something like that, I think.
It's been a minute, right?
Yeah, I think it was like 2016 maybe when I got mine, something like that, 9, 10 years ago nearly. So it's kind of one where they've kind of had this technology, they've iterated on it, they've brought it out as a, you know, almost as everyone thinks that Microsoft are doing with Game Pass, right? That Xbox has a... Yeah. Steam just have happened to get there first. Yeah. They and I don't know how they do this because they seem to be one step ahead of everybody all the time, but no one knows what they're doing.
Because they're focused on doing the thing, not doing things that will appease shareholders while they're trying to do the thing. Mm. And with Mike, we talked about this last episode, right, where Microsoft's Xbox group has to deal with the whims of greater Microsoft in a way that makes them probably fearful for their jobs in a certain sense, but also like have to do moves to appease the whims of the greater corporation, even if it's not in the best interest of the long term or even median term growth of Xbox, which should be in the best interest of the fucking corporation.
Yeah.
Because capitalism is broken. And my buddy Carl will tell you it was never not broken, but we were just living the bits. I will say, just because I was saying like low frame rate, low resolution, my point wasn't that it can't handle this for a lot of games. So I think the specs are, it's got DisplayPort 1.4, so it can output up to 240 hertz 4K or 8K at 60 hertz. My point was like the hardware power is likely not only to do that with like older games, which is fine, right? But like, again, when people are saying this is a low power device, they are comparing it to current gen graphics, etc. And they're not trying. You can't build a GameCube sized PC easily that can do that, right? And the point is, they're not trying to do that. They're not trying to compete with home-built gaming machines, and they're not trying to compete with the next gen of Xbox and PlayStation because those are a couple years out. And I think the fact that it on paper can on older games can do more than those because of the like DisplayPort 1.4, for example, right? Like it can output 8K 60 hertz. I don't think an Xbox can do that. But obviously that's an old shitty game, right? Like it won't have the power to render that unless it's a less intensive game. But like it can do what your console does. And again, if you have a machine in your house that's beefier and you don't have the really bad Wi-Fi or, you know, internet in general or network in general, as soon as you go to streaming, this thing is overpowered, right?
Sure.
I know, because I stream with a much less powered thing because streaming has, like, the graphic card needed for streaming is just vastly different, which is why Xbox was like, LG can sell you an Xbox TV because if you're streaming with a decent pipe, all it's doing is rendering but it just has to display the throughput and be able to process the throughput at that rate. That's no calculations. That's just display. It's not making the thing and then displaying the thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the Steam Machine is of all the products that they have, right? I have a Steam Deck. I'm like tempted by the Steam Controller. Also, the the fact that, so the big thing about the controller is it has a little puck you can like just tap it on to recharge.
Yes.
Which is like such a smart user for, like, they've thought about the users, and like, this is like one of the things that makes you like not do the thing is, oh, the batteries are kind of low, or it's like, I just don't have time to do that. And then I'm like, oh, I want to play a game, but I don't want to find fucking batteries. But also, that puck that it magnetically sticks to is also its wired connection.
Yep.
So your low latency is also charging your batteries. And it has a high-end, it has a dongle to make that better than Bluetooth. So just like all the other controllers, that's no big deal. So great. Yes, I'm trying not to overtalk because the Steam Frame is the thing that I'm also the most excited about.
Yep.
I think it represents the thing that, like, I've had OG, what the fuck is Steam's OG VR?
Oculus.
The pre-Index. So I had the Oculus. No, I had the Oculus DK1.
Yep.
And because I was a initial Kickstarter of the DK1, they sent me the CV1, the original commercial version. I bought the PSVR. I bought the original Valve. Why am I blanking on this? It's pre-Index, so it's the what before it got good. Let's just be honest. The Valve's original outside in VR.
Index is the first thing that kind of comes up. I can't maybe I put in original.
Cause the Index is the of course everything's time with the Frame.
Yeah, Index is still coming up. Yeah. Index and Frame are the things that are coming up at the moment, but I don't know. Valve VR headsets.
Valve VR hardware somewhere. History is what I'm going for. Now I just got Valve history. Or product. That's what I'm looking for.
But the one. The unit. The Valve unit.
Yeah. Was it an Index? Maybe it was an Index. No, it's the second generation headset for Alex. That was, yeah, that's the Index. What was the first one, though, you bastards?
I don't know.
Anyway, the thing before the Index, which arguably was fine.
It's been wiped from history.
Sorry?
It's been wiped from history.
It's wild that the Wikipedia article on Valve goes, it's super strange. Oh, the Vive.
Vive, yes.
Yes, the HTC Vive with Steam VR, because HTC, they didn't make that's the, right, the,
yes.
Right, that's why it wasn't showing up, because it was Steam branded, but HTC made the hardware, and then they said, fuck it, we're going to do it in-house for the Index, which is why it's technically their first in-house VR thing. Right. I also had, in fact, because I've been packing and unpacking, do you remember this moment in time of VR where you could buy? So this is the Google Daydream headset, where
is that the one you, like, plug your phone into it?
Yeah, you like look at the quality of this. So you have these very bad Fresnel lenses, and you literally just shove your phone on top, and then with this clearly secure pull tab elastic band, hook it in, and then you go, yeah.
No movement. Please do not move whilst wearing this headset.
Yeah. And then your navigation was. It's got a strap. It has a minus button, a power on button, and a touchpad that clicks. No one ever made anything for Daydream. It was a lost cause. I'm just saying, I've been in the weeds for this for a while. And the thing is, the Steam Frame is bonkers.
Absolutely.
So It is. So if like,
just the fact that it's wireless.
Yeah. So the big thing is it is a standalone PC in. So what they did was they put a standalone ARM-based PC in the headset,
yep.
which already has all the stuff. So it's already a weighty thing. And if you anyone who's done VR, so I also have an Oculus 2, I think,
mm-hmm.
not 3, but 2. Yeah. And it comes out when people visit, and I want to play the bomb game almost exclusively. Mm-hmm. The bomb game is fun. One of you in the room.
Keep talking. Nobody explodes.
Keep talking. So nobody explodes or whatever.
Mm, yeah.
Something like that. Or until everyone explodes. I can't remember. What I like about it is I've printed out the handbooks, and it's a party game, right? Everyone gets a handbook, and we like leaf through, and there's someone sitting in a corner in a totally different like mental space. But like one of the problems with that game is like. Because that's inside out. And so sometimes you like hit the barriers of what the cameras can see, but also grabbing things, you know, it just, the game is pretty old VR wise. And it's like, oh yeah, it was a bit clunky to pick things up and flip them around. And the thing is the UIs have gotten better though. And like, I'm pretty sure modern games on the same headset would work way better with the picking and flipping. Cause that's just like learning. So yeah, I've done this a lot, and so the most matte part of all of this hardware was the Steam Frames controllers just look like generic VR controllers, but also it makes sense because you want the so what like you just want to hold things and have some haptic triggers for fingers and have all the buttons. But the thing that's amazing about what they've done, which I think has been under talked about, and I know I'm like holding back, the like coolness of the Steam Frame is all the buttons, the Steam Frame control like handheld wands for lack of a better term has all the inputs of the Steam Deck minus the touchpads.
Yep.
Because you have gyros instead of touchpads. Mm-hmm. So that means you have two triggers, one of which is I can't remember the term, but the throttle-based sort of...
Yeah, the adaptive triggers.
Thank you. Adaptive triggers. And you also have the back triggers, mm-hmm. and you have the D-pad, you have the two fancy new magnetic-style joysticks, yep. and you have the four buttons. Such that so that's the thing. It's like, all that works, and the idea is pointing in the air should be what the touchpads are. That makes sense. Some people were complaining. I'm like, I don't know. I think everyone's done a lot. Now let's go back to the Steam Frame. It has the computer in it, and they've put a battery pack on the back of your head so that it can have actual runtime. But what's so smart about this, and like in retrospect seems so obvious, is because they've made the front heavy, but they put a heavy in the back, it's weight balanced.
Yeah.
So you don't get the fatigue of leaning forward that all of these have. And now they realize, we should counterweight it. Oh, why don't we counterweight it with a thing that makes it fucking infinitely more functional?
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. And I think this is one of the key things with almost all of this hardware is the ability to get your power units and your batteries and things to not necessarily be small, but incredibly functional. And again, with the Steam Machine, it doesn't have a power brick. It doesn't have that unit outside of the box. It's within the box. So there's no...
It's like a console.
You're just a normal plug to hardwire
it. Does PS5 have a...
No, PS5 doesn't. It's built in on the PS5. But it's always when... consoles bring out their like slim version.
Yeah. You don't have this fucking
laptops.
Thing.
Laptops have them. And it's always the slim. PS2 Slim, when that came out, giant power brick.
Right.
Because they're like, well, what can we get rid of? Well, the power unit. Let's put that outside like laptops do. Yeah. Okay. Great. We can. The PS2 was like this big. It's tiny. It's like the size of a book. Yeah. So Valve have been very, very clever. And they've, they've, they're, I think it is the, not necessarily just the way that they are doing it, but also then how they are using that, say, as you've just highlighted, as the counterbalance for the headset. And it's you know, the idea that this frame is wireless, it's got controls that would match the Steam Deck or match any control pad.
The consistency
control pad
in their fucking environment is
absolutely
on point.
Absolutely. And it's kind of one, you know, the form factor of it is very, looks at least very slick, very light. The Index was massive, right?
Yeah.
And almost all VR headsets have been relatively large. This is so small.
And it has, so this is the thing, if you look at the Apple Vision Pro, it's this very obtrusive thing. This thing is obviously a headset, but it's reasonably slimline, and it has a fucking computer in it. Like, yeah, old games can just run natively on it. That's a game changer, right? Like, it's not... So, Valve said that their approach was streaming first, which is why there isn't a USB-C connector to tether to.
Mm-hmm.
And you might think, oh, that sucks, but like, it shows how much they really just went for it, because... Yes, adding a tether would be very simple and like assuage a bunch of people, blah, blah, blah. But that's just more like, that's just a chipset and an actual piece of hardware. And I think the reason why they could get an ARM PC in the fucking head, like the front, not the back part, right? The front part of the headset with the lenses and all that stuff is because they just didn't make any like shifts towards appeasing other things, like, we are going to do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the key, so like the, there's a couple keys to this. One is like, just like the balancing thing. And again, it's primarily a VR streaming device that mm-hmm. also conveniently can play old games.
Yeah.
That's such a wild non-compromise, right? And so like how this works is Wi-Fi 6 is now legal. It's open, right? But nothing uses Wi-Fi 6. And one of the problems with the Wi-Fi 6 band is because of the size of the band, it doesn't go through walls as well. And so it's not, it has way higher bandwidth than Wi-Fi 5. So your 5 and 2.4 gigahertz, right?
Yep.
But it doesn't get, it's worse through walls. Right? So it's like, oh, this isn't going to solve the problem. Also, people don't, the average person doesn't need more throughput between their devices. They need more consistency. So Wi-Fi 6 is kind of like, it's not clear what types of things will adopt it. And right now the band is empty. And so what they're doing is literally giving you a dongle that can plug into your PC or your Steam machine. And it's literally just a pure Wi-Fi 6 connection between the Steam frame and the device.
Yep.
And that is enough low latency, high bandwidth, because you're in the room with the machine, that you get the speeds where you don't, where functionally there might be a couple millisecond difference, right, between a wired connection or not. But like the people can't perceive that.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, this is the answer. Wi-Fi 6 is like, not, but I think it's not just Wi-Fi 6 currently can do that, but also I don't think Wi-Fi 6 is going to crowd out in the same way 2.4 gigahertz was. To be honest, 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi, the biggest problem was fucking microwaves and cordless telephones, right? Because that bandwidth was open for a long time. I remember working in IT and having people in the business school complaining, and I fucking had, I took a scanning device and scanned multiple times, and like, your Wi-Fi is fine. And finally, we lucked out when someone used the microwave.
Yeah.
And we're like, there's a shit ton of interference. And we were there when we scanned. And I'm like, what is this fucking interference? Oh, you've got an old as shit microwave and it just kills 2.4 gigahertz. And because you guys are putting everything on your fucking Blackberries, because I'm old and that was what the fucking thing was at the time when I worked in IT. Like, Mary warming up her tea means you cannot do business. You're the business school. buy a fucking new microwave and you won't have this problem anymore.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting. When did 5 gigahertz come out? Not that long ago in a domestic sort of setting, right? It's been around for a few years.
It's been around for...
It's been around for a long time, but at least in home routers and things, it's a relatively new sort of band for people to be able to use. And I think this is great because as band 6, band 7, and things start to utilize those bands, we get the separation of usage of things. So phones use 5 a lot now. Other things use 5. I was worried because I've just done my bathroom, done it all myself. Yeah. Fit an underfloor heating system in my bathroom, right?
Oh, nice.
And it's got a Wi-Fi thermostat, so you've got to use it on your phone. All connects through, but it runs on that 2.4 band.
Ooh.
And I'm like, no, because I know how much my house interferes with that band in terms of the block work and the way it's constructed and stuff. Nothing. No issue whatsoever. Has had no problem connecting and changing settings and warming up the room ultimately. And I think we're getting to that point where things are getting separated enough that the interference is less these days. But it's clever of them again to go, let's switch and just use a completely free band to have that connection.
But I think it's not just that it's a free band, it's the fact that like the limitations of that band because of physics means that. So, like, one of the problems with 2.4 to 5 is 5 is less pervasive through walls, but it's not that far off. Like it gets through enough. And so 5 quickly got crowded out because people wanted the faster speed as to compared to 2.4. It was very much faster. But there is a literal physical trade-off with 6. Such that, like, 6 is great at 50 feet, no things in the way, but it tapers off even past that, and walls in the way start to make it bad, right? And so knowing that that's going to hinder, like, your fridge is going to stay on Wi-Fi 5, right? Like a 5 gigahertz, right? Your devices just need, so almost everything, like ideally a bunch of stuff is going to go to 5 because higher bandwidth and people just want the higher number. But those things are probably not going to go to 6. And if they do, they're probably worse. Because I want to fucking, I don't know, make my fridge throw ice on the ground. I don't know what the fuck you do with a fridge with a Wi-Fi. But like, I want to do that from the other side of the house, right? Like if I've bought one of these smart appliances, I don't want to be in the room with it. Because if I'm in the room, I'll just fucking open the fridge and then take ice from the ice bucket. Again, I don't know what people do with Wi-Fi fridges. But because of that, I think it's like quite smart and like really well thought out of like, this isn't a thing where in 2-3 years they're gonna be like, none of this works because now 6, like Wi-Fi 6 is banned, is overpopulated, because again it doesn't have that penetration, so your neighbors having it won't matter. You don't have that like overlapping footprint stuff, which was the biggest problem with 2.4, was it was so pervasive that your neighbor's Wi-Fi would make your Wi-Fi worse.
Yeah.
So if you knew what you were doing when you first set up your home network, you would scan and see what parts of the band were already being used, and you would put your network in the middle, right? That won't be an issue for this, but also because of that like limited scope, even if there was a lot of Wi-Fi 6 in your room, as long as you don't have 7 things with Wi-Fi 6, you're just going to, this will work. And like, again, it's that aiming in the same idea of like, what's the Steam machine trying to do? In your room, this will just be your console that can also also stream better than console shit if you have a better than console system upstairs.
Absolutely.
And here it's like, we're not trying to make your VR headset work outside of your room. So as long as you're in the same room as the thing with the dongle, like you just won't hit a use case where the band will be saturated, because the nature of the band is, your walls will protect you from saturation, and not many devices are going to start being that. Like, I really think it's super well thought out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sorry, you're going to say a thing.
Finish your thought.
Oh no, I was going to switch to the big win of the Steam Frame.
No, absolutely. Let's the only thing I was going to sort of mention is that video that they released outlining all of this said, "Hey, we've got the Steam Deck, and we'll talk more about that very shortly." Oh, so there's obviously a refresh of the Steam Deck coming as well. That you would imagine will fall in line even more so with all of this sort of stuff. And it's so fucking clever of them to have this consistent set of hardware all running very, very well, all optimized for each other, but also open enough that you can do other things on them.
Yeah. So I think there's a big thing about, at the end of the day, these are Linux machines and you can do what you want with them. They're all locked down, right? But because they're so well designed, I don't know why. So again, if you were trying to, it's interesting because they'll probably sell the Steam machine at a bit of a loss, but not enough of a loss that if you didn't want this like user experience, you wouldn't buy it, right? Like, you would buy a different small form factor PC, blah, blah, blah. Right? So, it's like the consistency is part of the package. And in that consistency, we'll use this as a slightly awkward segue into the thing I was going to say. It was one of the coolest things about the Steam Frame, because it has this ARM processor and Proton GE, is... Just like every piece of hardware they've released, it has a microSD expansion slot, high-speed microSD, which means it can have up to 1 terabyte of games on the fucking headset, right? I believe it's right on the nose piece, like right here is where the microSD slot is, which I just think is funny, because you're like, actually, oh no, I've rejected my games! but natively on the machine is basically the capability to have a virtual curved screen experience of any game that runs on the Steam Deck, basically any PC game. So that means you don't even need the 4K game monitor in your living room. You can sit on your couch, and your partner could be watching some TV show you're not super into, and you could just play a game. Do I think that's like a bit antisocial? Yes, but that's not the thing. The point is, like, you can just put it on and play. Most of the games I return to aren't of the past 5 years. This thing is obviously less powerful than the Steam machine and less powerful than the Steam Deck. But again, if you just had a Steam machine in the room with you and the dongle, you could play almost any game. But it's this very real, like, do I take, like, to be honest, it's like, if I'm playing an old school game and I had one of these on the Steam Deck and I went on holiday and I'm like, there's like, when I come back home and I just want to like play a game before bed, I might take that. Like, if I had a Steam Frame, I might take that just because I'm like, the immersion of a giant screen, etc., is, to me, way more immersive than slightly higher frame rate, etc. But like, it can be your standalone. And what I'm super curious about is the the streaming to it. So obviously, the streaming from a PC, so it's a streaming first VR headset. So it wants you to have a machine and be in the room with it to stream to it because of the Wi-Fi 6 dongle. But that's actually really flexible, right? Because you could buy an extra dongle and just have a very long USB C cable or whatever, right? Like, literally, I just rewired my house for networking, I'm like, I could just drop a USB cable from my fucking office to the living room, and then I could just be directly synced, and then I wouldn't need moonlight or whatever, right? I could, you know, and there's multiple different ways of doing this, but the point is, like, it has enough onboard capability. It probably rivals my home, my little living room PC as far as specs. Probably is better because my living room PC is a couple years old, whatever. But, like, when it's in streaming from mode, it doesn't need that much overhead, and it has it built in. All you need is that bandwidth, right? So it's like, oh, okay. So there's, like, a shit ton of things, and I guarantee you, because of the way they've well thought this out, there's, like, going to be a bunch of different approaches to, like, optimize this that the community is going to solve for them. Crucially, the community is going to solve for them. And I just, like, I'm super pumped, mostly because, oh yeah, the other thing is, I think it has five or seven cameras on it. Because they've never done inside out before, because they've always said the most accurate thing is the little boxes in your room.
Yep.
But obviously that means you have to have a dedicated room. And instead, what they've done is they've put more cameras than any other headset, I believe, ever. Because there are ones on the back of the headset, or, like, on the straps, like, near the end. And so the claim was, according to one of the YouTubers who went to their thing, is if you went back and, like, grabbed an arrow or, like, unsheathed the sword on your back, the cameras can track all of that, right? Mm. Which is one of the big problems with inside out tracking, is, like, at some point you lose the range, and it's like, oh, we just added a bunch of cameras. Again, what they did was realize for tracking, you don't need color cameras.
Yeah.
So they're all monochrome, every single one of them, but they're also cheap and affordable and producible, right? And so it's like, oh yeah, we can track you most of your body because of that, because we have five or seven, I can't remember the number, and they're well positioned, so everything you do can be tracked.
They've got four outward facing monochrome cameras for the controller and the headset, and that's two in the tops of the headset and two in the front of the headset, and then two internal eye tracking ones. No, I don't think there is one in the back.
I'm
looking on Steam. On Valve's listing.
I mean, it might just be that they're claiming that the, because again, the camera, if it has enough field of view,
mm-hmm,
it can capture a lot. So maybe they're just claiming the placement of the
I mean, potentially the placement back. There's two that are sort of, like, front facing, just underneath your eyes, but then there are two that I think look like they appear on the side as well. So whether they are capturing that peripheral just behind you as well, I think it depends on what their sort of field of view.
So the claim was, and I saw a couple, obviously this is in their, like, very restricted here's our demo thing, and so the channels also said, like, they did the thing and it seemed to track, but it was a controlled environment. But if it is accurate, again, that, and I'm gonna, like, weigh in on, like, they only went to Inside Out now. I'm pretty sure that they did Inside Out the right way because they waited this long. They were, right? I just have faith in the company that way. The jump to the Index and, like, Half-Life Alyx, if you ever got to play it, was a toy, right? Like, in the way that most VR is. And so this is why I was like, oh, but also this, like, built-in virtual display, Proton GE rendering any game in this 3D, potentially 3D, but definitely on your frame, play anything you want thing, is such an important thing, because I don't want a PC that, I don't want a machine that plays a few games when most of the developers are making experiences and not, like, full-fledged games.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I think is doomed VR. And it's like, oh, right, but I could just play the thing. And I guarantee, because one of the random purchases, one of the purchases I've made more in the past couple of years has been the AR glass, well, not AR, AR-ish glasses, right, from such that you have screens in the lens, and you can have a virtual dual display wherever you are at 1080p roughly. And that actually it has been really useful. Like, I've literally been on the train and been the nerd with the glasses on that are look like very bad slash thick Ray-Bans, right? But the thing is, I have two displays instead of just my laptop, and because they're screen and then opacity, I can actually leave the laptop on and have a third display if I want to look through. But I just am such a dual screen user because the ADHD and wanting to see things, if things aren't in front of me, they don't exist. And it was like, oh, this works, right? But like, one of the problems is it's 3DOF instead of 6DOF, such that, like, you can't just lean forward to, like, look closer because you lean forward and the screen moves.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff like that. And it's like, I never appreciated this. But that type of thing, it's like, oh, I actually think there's going to be... if this is actually as comfortable as the reports of people who've used it, there's like some game changing stuff. But also, because it's on Linux, because it runs Linux by its fucking self, I think like this thing could live in a lot of different spaces.
Very
in
much
a way that like Apple's gonna be really screwed. Well, not really, because people just want an open box thing, and all of the innovation on Steam type stuff has been people putting stuff on Git and you having to figure it out. But I think that's getting easier and easier. Like, I think the stuff that people have been doing on the Steam Deck from beginning to now has made it like really easy for someone who doesn't that techie to like buy a Steam Deck and install Deki and do these things. And then they realize that like aftermarket stuff sucks, because when they update Steam OS, all the Deki plugins screw up, and a couple of them will screw up in a way that won't let you fucking boot up your Steam Deck. Anyway, the Steam Frame seems really cool. I think I don't think there's any possible world where I don't try and be in the first layer of pre-orders. Like, I'm more pumped about this than I was for the Steam Deck. Mostly because like the Steam Deck was a bit of a, this seems neat and I think it'll help me play games when I'm in these like slumps, but I have things that play games.
Yep.
And I have things that do VR, but this also does both of those things. And I'm super curious about the tinkering. Let's be honest, I'm a tinkerer, right? And it's like, oh, I want to like check out how much openness is on the Linux and see what it means. Because like I said, I've tried these like Goggle-based systems on like and plugged it into an old laptop of mine and be like, oh, okay, well, that works, right? And it's like, okay, what if I didn't need that laptop? Well, how do I, like, I'm super curious of, like, if I had this thing, what peripherals would I need to make this, like, a workspace where I could also seamlessly in my living room stream at super high quality the game I'm currently playing, which is... obviously hypotheticals, I don't play games anymore. But yeah, I think I've talked a lot. I actually feel like I cast over your excitement on the Steam Frame, and I'm super curious.
No, not at all, not at all. I think it's kind of one where I think this is the sort of thing that would pull me into VR much more than anything else. You know, the PSVR, PSVR 2, kind of, you know, I've got VR the box in my room, but it's cumbersome, it's full of cables, it's a pain in the arse, I would imagine. This is light, it's very easily hideable from small fingers. And you can put it away rather than the PSVR 2 being quite a large sort of unit and things. So I think it's form factor, it's small design, but again, all of those little things that we've talked about, all that attention to detail that we've talked about has me really excited for this. And I've kind of dabbled in VR. I borrowed your units previously and done a few sort of press sort of things that had me kind of like, yeah, I like this, but nothing's ever really wanted me to kind of grab it and go, yes, this is the next sort of thing. And I don't know whether the Frame will on a wider basis, but for people who are kind of thinking, you know, I could be enticed by VR, this is the kind of thing that will bring them in.
I think, yeah, so obviously I'm of the very like wanting to try the cool thing. I've clearly spent too much money on these systems. I'm the mark, or whatever you want to call it. And I think this thing will still not hit the mainstream, which is why I think the Apple Vision Pro was like DOA. I just think it was trying to do too much. They were targeting it to all Apple users, and it's way too big of a leap, and it doesn't do enough stuff. One of the things, though, that the people who like use those things was the idea of virtual monitors, which is why I was like, oh, I'm super curious, because as Linux, what you could do, and again, I have a pair of AR glasses, or whatever you call them, that I actually have used, to be too honest, when I've been under the weather and sitting in bed, but needing to do some work, and not at my computer where, like, I have two monitors, or I have, like, this 23-inch slightly odd form factor monitor. In my office, I have three monitors, because one monitor is just, like, task tracking, etc. It replaces the idea of a whiteboard where I'm writing, this is what I wanted to do today, and then there's a monitor for reading, and there's a monitor for the active task. So if I'm, like, researching, I can, like, look at the two things without having to get rid of the task list, because the only way the task list works is if it's there in my face all the time. Thanks, ADHD. And the thing is, when I'm on a laptop, I don't get that option. And now that I've gotten used to that system, like, oh, this sucks. And then I plugged in these fucking glasses, I was like, oh, this kind of works.
Yeah.
And obviously, I'm not going to, like, the coffee shop with my laptop and then plugging in these nerd glasses. I've done it once on the train, and I felt real weird. But I did get the stuff done in, I think, last time that it would have mattered. But the thing is, with that, like, wider field of view for VR, but mostly it's like, if it can handle streaming these games, etc., if that hardware was at that level of you could kind of game natively, then the bullshit office tasks and rendering three virtual screens should be very straightforward.
Yeah.
And also it could be the thing where you're like, oh, I just really want to play, like, say, I'm going to say Skyrim, just because, like, immersive game X. And if I do it on this thing, streaming from my PC or natively, depending on the age of the game, it's going to be so big that, like, I actually have to look left and right. There are games where that's a game changer, right? You feel more immersed. That's one of the reasons why I really liked VR. And playing games that were not made for VR in VR, where I would just make a virtual screen wide enough, such that I would have to look left and right. I would have to use my field of view in the field of view of the game to navigate, and I just felt like I was the person, and that made that game much richer as an experience. Nice. And the fact that you can do all of that on a bunch of old games, and probably a lot of new ones, right? But, like, you can do that by just putting a thing on your head and owning nothing else. That's the thing that I'm super pumped with.
Yeah, good, good.
Anyway,
That's a good point.
You were going to talk about actual games.
I was going to talk about actual games. I think we're running out of time. I do have.
I was going to say, I feel like we overtalked this one, but
It's a big thing. It's big news. It's a big release that's kind of coming up. So absolutely. One thing I will, before I mention anything else, I had a thought in my head about your beer, and for some reason, for some reason, I kept having the word alchemist pop into my head. And I'm like, Alchemist is a US brewery, isn't it? And they brew the beer Heady Topper, which is a silver can with black writing. Oh. It is
what you call it, sorry?
Heady Topper.
That is the beer, I think, that other Ben mentioned. Thank you. Yeah. I
think
I, like,
that is what they are aping. The can, the silver with the black... kind of just, it was bothering me for the last sort of like 20 minutes, so I had a quick look online.
I'm really glad you figured that out, because I couldn't, my brain just wasn't getting there. They also have one currently on release, and it's a riff on Left Handed Brewery's very famous Colorado beer.
Okay.
And so they just say it's a riff on Colorado beer, but then the symbol at the top of their can is like a red hand going like this instead of
a red hand
going like this.
Right.
And I was like, I see what you're doing. And Ben just told me all this. And I was like, I didn't know this was a thing. That's super interesting. And part of me was like, where are they in? They're in Cheshire, I think. Because I'm just like, I feel like this is like a, if possible, field trip we haven't known a field trip episode in a while, right? But it's like, oh, if we could go there and talk to them about, first of all, their general history is super neat, right? Because they're just like a bunch of people have been dabbling in breweries, and that's why it's their weekend project. And then I was like, oh, but also, if they're doing this new riffs on famous beers thing, I want to know more about that. Like, I want to hear that, and I'm guessing you listeners might. So that's my, like, as of 3 hours ago, it was like, oh shit, I should like dig a little deeper into this.
This is what we're trying to. This is what we'll organize for the spring as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Good.
But you are entirely right. That is the beer they're trying to riff on. And good. Now, cool. Now part of me wants to go find it.
God, can you find Heady Topper somewhere? You probably can. To be fair, someone will import it over here. Yes. To move us on. Sorry, I know there was something you wanted to talk about as well.
No, this is fine. This was the main piece of news. There was like a small thing. It's fine.
Cool. I will very briefly mention that I have been playing Moonlighter 2. Which is a sequel to Moonlighter, which is a game I very, very much enjoyed several years ago, which had a fantastic loop to it where you ultimately are running a shop.
Yep.
And in your shop, you are selling items that you pick up from a dungeon. Moonlighter 2 is more of the same, just with a few more systems, area-specific mechanics for mm-hmm. how the relics and items that you're picking up kind of work, how you can upgrade them, how you can improve them, how you can do things on runs. You now have, rather than Moonlighter, where you are moving through rooms in a dungeon, you are just more in the style of Slay the Spire, where you have a map and you pick your path kind of through.
Oh, interesting.
With different biomes, different sort of areas and things like that, all leading up to a boss. So you have, I think, maybe 10 rooms or 10 areas kind of within this map to move through. It's a game that I can't put down, and I've got codes for other games that I have dabbled in that I'm just being pulled away from by Moonlighter. It's more of the same that the first game gave me, and I love that. So this is very good, and it's slimmed down the shop, I feel, a little bit, but actually streamlined it to make it that little bit simpler, that little bit more accessible. It's not quite as maybe intense as it was, or it's almost exactly the same and the other elements of the gameplay have jumped that little bit, that this doesn't feel like it has moved that much. But actually, I don't feel like it needs to have moved that much. It was already a very good experience, so I will mention and give that. Maybe I'll talk about it in the coming weeks when I've not beaten a boss on a run yet. I've opened 3 worlds up. I haven't beaten a boss once. So the game progresses as you collect and sell items. You make more money, and the game actually progresses its story more so in that you're achieving monetary goals rather than having to beat bosses. So you can just do runs and go, cool, I quit here. I'm jumping back. I'm portaling back to the place that we live, to the shop, and I'm going to sell all the goods that I have rather than trying to do a boss run. And that is sort of what I have been doing a little bit more. But I've had a couple of goes where I'm like, actually, I'll pick the upgrade paths through this map rather than going to get the items and finding the chests and things like that, just so I can try and go and get to the boss. And it's got a lovely difficulty curve. It starts out, it feels quite hard to begin with, but actually you get a couple of upgrades, you're like, oh, this is that little bit easier. Maybe I'm still not quite at the boss. A couple more upgrades, oh cool, I'm at the boss. It beat me. A couple more upgrades, great, I may be able to then do this. A variety of weapons as well to choose from, close combat, fast sort of stuff to heavy two-handed swords and things like that. So it builds on the first game really, really well.
I was just saying, so in that difficulty curve, I'm just curious, I know it's been a minute since you played the first one, do you feel like it's that curve is smoother, just as rough,
hard to remember? No, I think from memory, I think it's probably very similar. And the first game, yeah, again, it eased you in. This game does, you know, the first room is incredibly easy, gives you that kind of like a very leading sort of level of combat. This is what you've got to do. It's very lightweight. There's like three enemies. Cool, kill them. Great, you've done that. The next room might have five. The next room might have four. But then when they die, four more spawn. And builds on it very nicely kind of through a run. When you then move to the next level, the next biome, it steps it up in that some of the enemies have a little bit more health, or their attack patterns differ in a way that you haven't encountered before. So you've got to learn a little bit of the language again in what they're doing, but not detrimental. You know, it's not that different. There's sub-bosses. And I think when I was talking about Devil Jam last episode, one of the issues was that the bosses were cycling a little bit too much, and I wasn't getting a handle on the attack patterns of some of the bosses on that first sort of level. Whereas this goes, here is a sub boss that cycles a little bit. There might be two or three sub bosses, but the boss at the end is the same. So you can learn what they're doing. You know, you've achieved this run. You've got through 10 rooms. Now hit this boss, which is going to stay the same as you kind of run through. But the sub bosses were not difficult, but are a bit more of a challenge because you're like, oh, here's a new one,
right? Yeah,
and I think that's the good thing about it. There is consistency in the game, but enough diversity and enough challenge that it doesn't feel cheap when I die.
Right.
You know, I'm not like, fuck, I really shouldn't have. You know, I'm actually like, oh, that was because I wasn't paying enough attention.
It's still in early access, right?
It is. It is. Yeah. I think it released in early access a couple of days ago. I don't think it's... I don't know whether it has a date. Oh, yeah, yesterday, in fact, it released in early access. I don't know if it's got a date, but it's kind of... There are a few things on here which... say a couple of elements which say coming soon and stuff like that on the game still.
I was just double checking because it sounds quite... So why I said that was because it sounds like they've done the hard work of why my previous question was like, how smooth is that difficulty curve? Because ultimately I think like games live and die on that difficulty curve being smooth. It's not the slope, right? It's how smooth we get up, which obviously is what part of the slope is, right? Like, so you can have things... Like, I think that's why Elden Ring was such a good success, is they made sure that slope was smooth for the core gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you... By the time you bumped into the hard parts, you understood kind of how the jags worked and because they were presented smoothly. And like to the point where it's like, I remember like discovering an area and be like, well, nope, I'm not going to do this. Like the game gave me why I think it's one of the best open world games ever made is because they gave me access to the thing. But because of the way I traversed the game, I was like, no, I don't want to do this. Because I understand I'm going to get fucked here, right? Mm. Like, there was just... Because the difficulty was always ramping up a bit, and the way they ramped up difficulty was well-telegraphed, nice, smooth understanding. When I came to this new thing, it's like, oh, I've, like... I don't know if I've, like, short-circuited a critical path, or I've found a really interesting new place. This isn't going to work, because I understand this game really well, because you've, like, telegraphed... what the curve should look like, and the first person I attack, I'm like, this ain't it, right? And the thing is, I went to a couple areas in my run, like, I didn't finish the game. Surprise, surprise, I'm still not finishing a game. But, like, I went to a couple areas, like, two-thirds of the game through, or wherever I got to, where I was like, I'm not well-equipped for this, but I think I can get there. And again, that, like, by giving that smoothness, by giving that information on... how, like, I could interpret, like, this fight sucked, but I think I could probably get through this area because I've gone through enough of the game and they've given me enough opportunities to, like, figure out that curve, because I think that smoothness is kind of the same throughout the whole game, again, as far as I played. It's like, I might have a miserable time, but I think I can get through this new area, and it's interesting to me, so fuck it. I'm not going to wait. I'm not gonna go grind and come back. It's like the anti-FF move, right?
Sure.
Where you find the secret area, you're like, okay, so it turns out I just need to, if I want to deal with it now, I'll just grind for 17 hours and then come back. Right? I think it was like superbly well-crafted in that way.
Yes.
Where you found out very quickly if it was manageable or you're fucked or okay.
Yeah, and I think Moonlighter 2 balances that really well as well, because you will generally, even if you after a few rooms are not feeling the biome, or you're not getting sort of the language and you are starting to sort of die, you can jump out of it, but you can still then sell all of the relics that you've picked up, and you have you sell them, you get the money, and then you can go and buy an upgrade. Normally, every single run, I've been able to buy some level of upgrade. And there's a lot of different upgrades that you can buy: equipment, new weapons, upgrades to your sort of health and the potions that you have, upgrades to your backpack so you can carry more items. You know, there's a ton of stuff to be able to kind of upgrade in this as well. So it doesn't ever feel like you're futilely doing a run or hitting a point where you're having that experience where you go, no, this is too much for me. You can go, actually, yes, this is too much for me. I will just jump out and then start the loop again. You know, it's very succinct. It's quite short. I think a run can take between sort of like 15 and 25-ish kind of minutes when you're in those sort of areas. And the shop lasts for, 2 minutes or something until you've sold all the items that you've got, maybe five. I'm really enjoying it. It's going to be something that I talk about more in the coming weeks as I sort of explore it.
Obviously it's early access and it's been a minute since you've played the first one. I'm just curious, like, one last question just of like, is there a sense of continuity from Moonlighter 1, or is it more like it's a similar type game?
Narrative-wise. Narrative-wise, it is a continuation. So you're the same character, you're Will. You are the same shopkeeper. It's changed in style from a sort of more 2D, very, very vibrant sort of pixel art into a 3D view, but it's an isometric 3D view, right?
That's such a good move from 2D. Like, then if there's a Moonlighter 3, it could be Moonlighter 3D in the way that
it's not the same.
No, 2010's called.
What was the game recently, which is the extraction shooter, Hyperlight Drifter, and that changed to Hyperlight Breaker, where, again, you were almost a top-down pixelated game, and this then turned into a third-person sort of action game. Moonlighter 2 continues with its tone, continues with its aesthetic. It's just changed it very slightly to make it a little bit more modern, and it's still just as vibrant. It's lovely, it's colorful, it's very cartoony still. You get the same aesthetic, really, even though it's in a slightly different format. And the characters all come, some of the characters come with you from the first game as well. So there's that continuity of story.
I didn't play the game, so I'm assuming there wasn't, I guess when you have sequels like this, it's like either the first game didn't have a lot of choice points that changed your end state, or they've got some like notion of why the end state is malleable in the beginning state of the sequel. I'm assuming this wasn't an issue in the transition. It just felt like we were playing, I played this game, and then I came back a couple years later, and the game was also a couple years later, which I believe is the case, right? They set the game several years later after the end of the last game.
It could be. I can't remember from what I've picked up whether it's a couple of years afterwards or it's sort of like just after. Yeah.
But if that is the case, I think that's such a smart move, because it gives you all kinds of narrative leeway of a couple years of things happening. But also it mirrors the actual life of the fucking player.
Yes.
It's like, I finished this game, and like, if I played this at release, but even like kind of took my time finishing it, I finished it 4 years ago. And then you're like, some years passed since the end of that game, so you don't know what happened. You weren't in fucking control. Like, I think that's like such a neat narrative move, and that I wish games like it's like an untapped resource of like, right, we took 7 years to make the sequel. You, unless you like picked it up real late and just finished it, you will have had to wait. And the thing is about having to wait is 2 years, 5 years are kind of the same in like, in terms of, you can just tell the like the player, you finished here, and then some shit happened that you didn't have control over, and now you have control again in this new place, and you're not just starting at that moment that you have to be like, what are all the things I did? Because the game wants me to like pretend like I just finished this game and like those last two missions were fresh in my mind. I actually think that's like an untapped resource in like putting the development cycle into the narrative.
Yeah, right?
Like, unless I just replayed the game, I'm not going to remember all these details.
Yeah.
And if you're doing a direct sequel, like temporally, I'm going to be fuzzy and feel weird about it.
Also, but actually, you've got new people, right, that don't know the story from sort of the first game. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So yes, I will talk about it in the coming weeks, but let's finish there for tonight and round out the episode with our beers. And we will come back to you first for the Weekend Project. What was it called? Elephant something?
Elephant Rock by Weekend Project, which apparently was, I've already forgotten what you told me it was.
Heady Topper. On.
Yeah. It's fucking good. It's a fucking good beer. I think it's so well-rounded. I think it's rare to find like a DIPA that is this satisfying in a way that it's not like, oh, it does this, then that, then this. Like, I think this is why I was struggling in the beginning of the episode of describing it, because it was like, it just had a very fluid taste curve, and there was like five hops listed, and I could, and because I know what those hops do, I was like, oh, that's, I can find those bits and pieces of the taste curve that like are doing that, but there wasn't this ebb and flow between the moments of the taste. It mostly just like was like, oh, this tastes really good. Like, it just felt, I'm going to say the word generic, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean like it's not flat or generic, but I really want to reach for those words because the thing that it reminds me of is just like flat generic taste curves are just like really consistent. And has this consistent taste throughout that I could tell you what's like in it because it has these tastes, but it's so well crafted that I'm just like, yeah, it has this continuous taste, and it's not Citra and it's not Cascade, because of course it's this combination of them. And it's excellent. And it's one of those things where the ways I would want to describe it feel like things that I would use to critique it because of the words I'm trying to reach for.
Sure.
And that's not what I'm trying to do.
No,
I just think it's so well melded together that I don't want to say it has this taste, that taste, this taste, because that's what makes it so good. Because kind of the point is, if I was, every time I just like reach for a sip, I didn't find this taste, that taste, that taste. I just had this really enjoyable taste.
Solid.
Yeah, and it's really rare for a beer, especially with this many hops, to just be that consistently fluid. That's why I think this is a great beer.
Nice. I will say with the Arbor, the Panettone Festive Pale Ale, the flavor did dull down as I was drinking it. You know, my palate became acclimatized to it. I got used to those flavors, and it lost a little bit of its initial sort of sheen, but still good. Still a nice flavor. It just wasn't quite as strong in pushing those flavors. About half a pint, something like that. It started to lose it a little bit. And maybe that's just because we've been sat here for an hour and a half and it's taking me an hour to kind of get through, that it started to lose those elements. But it's really nice. It's a lovely, lovely light beer. If you want something light and you want something that little bit more flavored and something different from a fruity pale ale. This is, it is fruity, but it's got a lot of other stuff kind of going on and brings in a lot of other flavors that you don't generally get, like raisin and the combination of that with vanilla and a few other things. So it's very, very nice. I will pick up another one of these, definitely, for the coming weeks. Maybe even for a little Christmas Day tipple as I'm starting to build my stash up. Good. That's a lovely place for us to finish. If you want to tell us the beers that you've been drinking or the games that you've been playing, you can do so over on Blue Sky Out of Lives Net. Is it Out of Lives Net? I always think it's Out of Lives Net. Yes, it is outoflives.net. You can go to outoflives.net as well, comment on the podcast post or look at the articles that other people write for the website. I am Nova47 over on Blue Sky. Adel is
at the Omniarch.
And that's all the places. Rate review us on your podcast service of choice. Hit us up on YouTube if you want. Do the things. All helps. Join the conversation. Blah, 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 blah. Thank you for joining us. We've been tanked up. Goodbye.
Ciao.
www.outoflives.net.